This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. Our guest this week is Neil McCormick, member of the European Parliament and Regius Professor of Public Law at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and her topic will be the European Union. Neil, glad to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I wonder if you could begin by giving just a brief description of exactly what the European Union is, because I think a lot of my listeners simply wouldn't, you know, they've heard the phrase, but they don't really know much about it.
Well, the European Union is a union bringing together 15 of the states of Europe, currently of Western and Southern Europe. We hope it will expand across into Central and Eastern Europe in the next 4 or 5 years. It's a union brought about by treaties among the member states, which have created a single internal market, which have created the conditions for common foreign and security policy to some extent, and which have created conditions for cooperation in matters of justice and home affairs. It therefore expresses both the economic and the political union of peoples in Europe. Peoples who, we must remember, were in the first half of this century divided by appalling wars, and the determination to create a new polity in Europe where war is a thing of the past, and where people cooperate rather than antagonize each other is the thing.
Okay, certainly we're going to look at the elements of that. I wonder, too, if you could give just a brief history of the European Union. I mean, did this happen all at once? Did it happen incrementally? What briefly happened to bring it to the place where we have the European Union as we now have it?
Well, it happened incrementally. The first move towards union occurred just at the beginning of the 1950s with the creation of the European Coal and Steel Community. This was a group of particularly France and Germany and the Low Countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, and the Luxembourg, squeezed in between France and Germany, and then also Italy, which decided to come in at that point. The years we speak of were still years of reconstruction after the fearful devastation in both France and Germany, in Italy and in the Low Countries, caused by war. The essential materials of war are iron and steel. So the idea of creating a coal and steel community to collaborate in the production of coal and steel and to stabilize markets was a first step towards bringing together this idea of European collaboration. A further treaty concerned the development of atomic power, the Euratom Treaty, which was an attempt to ensure that atomic power would develop peacefully in Europe. And then, most decisively, in 1957-1958, the Rome Treaty established the European Economic Community. So we are then three communities: the Euratom Community, the Coal and Steel Community, and the European Economic Community. But they shared certain common institutions, and the process over the succeeding years, in effect, fused them into a single community. Countries like the United Kingdom, Denmark, Ireland, Sweden, Norway, which had remained outside the Union, the economic community, I should say, in 1957-58, gradually came to think that they had perhaps made a mistake in doing so, that the dynamic of growth and development in Europe made it essential for them to come in. Under Mr. Harold Macmillan as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and other countries applied to join the European Community, but General de Gaulle, as then President of France, in a famous way vetoed that, saying that Britain was too much an Atlanticist power, not enough a European one, and that it wouldn't be bringing an attitude of full-hearted collaboration into the Union. And that froze the matter for another 10 years. But in 1972, new negotiations were carried out successfully, and it was open to the United Kingdom, Denmark, Ireland, and Norway to join at that time. The United Kingdom, Denmark, and Ireland came in. Norway, on a narrowish vote, decided to stay out, essentially on the grounds of protecting the fisheries. Subsequent countries to come in were Spain and Portugal, after they had re-established democratic government and got rid of their dictatorships. Likewise, Greece, when the colonels had been put into the past and a democratic constitution fully established. Austria, once its effective neutralization after the war was held to cease being an obstacle. Sweden, which had felt increasingly isolated in the north, and Finland came in. Norway, yet again, decided that its fish and oil interests were too vitally affected to come in. So that's how we got to the size we're at now. Since 1989, that amazing period, 1989 to 91, when the Cold War came to an end and the Soviet Empire collapsed, there has been progress and much striving towards bringing in Central and Eastern European countries like Hungary, the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, Slovenia, the Baltic states, and other significant parts such as, of course, Poland, which are very much belong in Europe, but for a long time the tragic division of Europe created, as Churchill famously said, an iron curtain down the middle.
Okay, I'd like you just to elaborate on just a bit on two points. Yeah. When you talk about what motivated this union, I mean, here are our countries that had a history of being at war with one another, and all of a sudden they begin to make these steps incrementally toward forming this union, an increasingly tight union. You mentioned two things in particular. One is security and the avoidance of war, and secondly was economic advantage. And I wonder if you could just elaborate on each of those a bit.
Well, I think that you don't have to be a Marxist to think that politics have important economic bases, that prosperity is one of the guarantees of peace. People who are well off are not apt to wantonly attack their neighbor. And if you take the view that that markets function as what are called non-zero-sum games, that in trading, everybody gets better off because you reallocate goods in a more efficient way, and the bigger the market, the more that takes effect, the more people find employment involved in it. So idea number one says if we can build an effective common market for the time being, the 367 million West Europeans within the Union, the 500 million perhaps in due course, then you do create the condition for a stable and continuing prosperity. Of course, there are conditions on that. If there are grave inequalities among different parts, you may need to do things to assist the poorer areas at the expense of the richer. And we have things called structural funds, which essentially have that redistributive function to bring up to a satisfactory standard parts which have lagged behind for historic reasons or reasons of extreme peripherality or whatever. So that there's the prosperity aspect. And on the other side, there is the knitting together into a political union in which people, without losing the sense that they are French or German, Italian, whatever they might be, are also members of a greater European enterprise, and they have a common European identity as well as separate local particular national identities within that European community. And that, of course, depends. So we've got peace by collaboration and prosperity, but essentially predicated on a third idea, which is that of supranationality, that we need something which is above the traditionally conceived nation-state, or which is beyond, let us say, the traditionally conceived nation-state, which creates institutions and, in a way, a constitution in common among the states to create the conditions of the cooperation and to silence, perhaps forever, that version of nationalism, of nation-statism, which, despite all its progressive implications in some ways, was seen to have led to the bitter rivalries, the imperialist rivalries, and the wars of the first half of the 20th century.
Okay, so the various benefits of the Union are not unrelated. In fact, they're deeply related. There's an assumption that if you have peace, it will advance economic prosperity, and if you have a certain kind of economic prosperity in relationships, it will increase the chance for peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems, given as you've described it, that there's a sense in which the European Union is completely unique in world history. I mean, there, in the case of the United States, you had states coming together to form a federal government, and perhaps there's a sense in which the United Nations is at least somewhat a model, but the European Union seems unique in that the nature of the relationship is so much tighter than has ever been accomplished in the world before. Is that exaggeration, or does that seem right?
I think that's right. We shouldn't make too grandiose claims. I mean, India is a huge federation of many languages, many peoples within a subcontinent, and they also have managed to keep things going in one federal state since the more or less the same period of history. So let us not claim that we Europeans have totally unique virtues and institutions. But I do think that what you have in Western Europe is characterized by the fact that you have a set of states which are not, say, as in the United States of America, recently liberated ex-colonial territories sharing a common legal tradition and a common similarity of institutions. What you had was very ancient nations and states with very different constitutional, political traditions, linguistic differences, and a history of mutual enmity. You know, we fight each other every generation kind of thing. So that building something together from these building blocks was a challenge, I think, on a grander scale than had been seen before. The decisive thing, really, was the degree of intimacy of interrelationship that the foundation treaties brought about. And from quite an early stage, the Court of Justice of the Communities, the European Court of Justice, took an interesting line. It said that the treaties themselves and the rules which the institutions make using the powers conferred by the treaties are a law of a new kind. They're neither the law of a nation state, nor are they, in the traditional sense, international law. We've created a legal community which is, as they said, sui generis, of its own kind. But it really is bound by laws. And these laws have two qualities which were vitally important in developing the idea. One, they enjoy supremacy within their sphere of application. Necessarily, they override the law of the states. Because if you're trying to create an economic community, a level playing field for fair and free trade, you must be sure that the rules you make apply equally everywhere. And therefore also, a second point, they have direct effect. It's not just that the state of France or the state of Germany is obliged to ensure that it does things in conformity to the treaties, but the rights and obligations which arise under the treaties directly bind and directly endure in favor of individual citizens, companies, and so on, so that people have rights that they can appeal to under European law, and they can demand that they be made effective, if necessary, setting aside state law. So it is rather, it's not at all unlike a federal system. Indeed, you might say, in the big family of federation, this is a kind of a federal, I would prefer to say confederal example. But it does therefore mean that you have this new non-state union of states, which has its own constitutional structure and order, its own body of law. In that sense, it is a novelty in human history. Of course, it may be simply a great beast struggling to better him to be born, as the poet said. It may be you know, that this is something in the process of becoming just an ordinary federation like the United States or perhaps like India, but perhaps not. Perhaps we will retain this idea that the political and legal forms of the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries don't perfectly capture what this continent of peoples needs for its self-governance in the 21st.
Now, these sort of interesting and unique features, you've talked about supranationalism in some of your works, you've talked about the principle of subsidiarity, and in fact you talked just a moment ago about the idea of direct effect of the decisions of the European Union. All this seemed to create a problem for the way that most people thought about nationalism and sovereignty, that each country was sovereign and that somehow that sovereignty couldn't be given up to some other supranational organization. And in particular in the case of the United Kingdom, I know the worry has been, can one parliament effectively bind what later parliaments do? Could you explain this legal problem and perhaps how some of the countries, maybe the United Kingdom, have tried to deal with it?
Yes. I suppose the typical essential definition of the nation-state of the modern period, let us say of the 19th and 20th centuries, was that it was a sovereign state. That is to say that all the laws that bound it and bound people in it, ultimately were made by it or with its consent. And under democratic theory, of course, that the state was simply, in a way, the personification of the people, as the United States Constitution commences, we the people make this constitution for ourselves and declare that we will be governed under it. So the idea then was you get two things going together, democracy and independence, that the world has to be divided into sets of people, each one a sovereign people in charge of a state controlling territory and limited only by the norms it makes or consents to in the context of the rather weak body of public international law that existed and the rather questionable body of treaty law that existed and was so flagrantly ignored, for example, in the outbreak of the First and Second World Wars. That's the idea that we start from. Inside that idea, you have different constitutional traditions. In the United Kingdom, the legal theory of the state was that this state's sovereignty is vested in the Parliament, or strictly speaking, the monarch, the King or Queen, in Parliament, and all laws must originate from the will of the Parliament, or attend it. Nothing can be law that isn't tacitly consented to by Parliament, and everything can be changed by Parliament. Okay, if you then say, now we're inviting you, putting out the project for you to join something like the European Union, you face an apparent paradox. If this is a sovereign parliament, then certainly it can decide, yes, we will take our people into this union, this community, and we will adopt its governing norms as our norms. They will apply and have direct effect among us as in the other countries, and that is simply an attribute of our sovereign power that we do, by which we do this. But, of course, the problem then is it revocable? You have the same problem as came to the fore in the years up to 1861 in America. If sovereign peoples, sovereign states, come together and pool powers and functions in common institutions, can they be revoked? And if you have a doctrine like the doctrine of supremacy and direct effect, it doesn't seem as though subsequent parliaments in the United Kingdom, or indeed in any other country, can pick and choose and say, oh, we don't like this bit of European law or this implication of European Union, so we'll exempt ourselves from it while we go on collaborating on the other points. In effect, it has to be that there is an element of irrevocability in the decision to join. Now, the theorists of sovereignty said, of course, that there was only one exception to the power of the sovereign state or the sovereign parliament, namely, it could surrender it to another body, but always it would be in a unitary condition, whatever it was. So that theory said, well, either in 1972 the United Kingdom completely ceased to be sovereign and passed all its sovereignty to the European institutions, or it completely failed to pass anything more than delegated power to the Union, because sovereignty is always complete and in one place. Now, it seems to me, as we look at the way the European Union has developed, it makes that theory of sovereignty obsolete, because certainly in the current state of things, there is no full or plenary sovereignty enjoyed by the European Union. It has restricted powers and functions conferred under the treaties, and the treaties are pretty faithfully observed. But the consequence is that the states also no longer have full or plenary sovereignty, because they've committed themselves, they're bound. It may be an important point to say that the theory of this does leave a residual and implicit right of secession, that a sovereign state which went in retains a kind of residual or shadowy sovereignty in the sense that if in due course they decide they wish to leave, then that decision would be valid by national constitutional law and not overridden by European law. It would clearly be a very grave political situation when that happened and would call for all sorts of careful negotiation, and for the time being it has never even seemed remotely likely that anybody was going to do it. But there is that question about a residual possibility, but as things stand it does look as though in the traditional legal sense, particularly that legal sense that associates with British constitutional theory, sovereignty has now been transcended.
And I take it at least one of the reasons, I mean there are probably multiple reasons, but at least one of the reasons why you don't foresee any country trying to pull out and raising this great problem is that it appears the European Union in fact has been incredibly beneficial to all its members.
Yes. The views, opinions about this, it has to be said, among the citizens of Europe fluctuate. At the moment, there's a prevailing lack of optimism, even an air of scepticism in many countries, not only in the United Kingdom, a doubt that the Union is all it's cracked up to be. Perhaps it's too much dominated by bureaucrats, faceless bureaucrats living in Brussels and so on. So I think that in terms of popular opinion, there have been times when the Union has seemed like a very good thing indeed, and other times when it has seemed less popular. But I do think that the underlying economic realities are of huge mutual interpenetration of economies and going, so that the economic penalty that a people would pay if it did exercise its admitted sovereignty to leave would be a very big one. And I think that would, for almost all purposes we can think of, be politically decisive once a question became focused in a concrete way. Actually, the development of a common currency in Western Europe will pose this proposition rather interestingly. There is to be, at some point in the coming years, a referendum inside the United Kingdom to decide whether we should authorize our government to exchange the pound sterling as our governing currency for the euro, the new Europe-wide currency. Now, in terms of popular sentiment, that will be a difficult choice for many people to make, but probably the government of the day will argue that it is for the very great economic advantage, and I think quite possibly the existence of currency and coins circulating throughout all the rest of Europe will make a big difference to public opinion. Frankly, I certainly hope so. So that there will be occasions when we'll be able to test in a practical way the real will of people as distinct from as what you might call the phenomenal will reflected in opinion polls and popular newspapers.
All right, let's go in a slightly different direction here. I mean, you use the language in your writings, and certainly the implication you've given when you were giving some of your earlier answers is that Europe has moved into a stage of post-sovereignty, that sovereignty as we once thought about it in Europe at least no longer exists. One of the interesting phenomena, it seems to me, is that that's not only been going on between nations, but to varying degrees within nations.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how it compares with what's going on between nations.
Well, nation itself is a contested concept. I mean, for example, many of the so-called nation-states of Western Europe, like the United Kingdom, like Spain, certainly Germany, also France, and clearly Italy, are what modern political commentators and theorists call union states. They brought together by historical processes different peoples and kingdoms and created what appeared like unitary states out of them. I mean, for example, the United Kingdom originated in a treaty between Scotland and England in 1707, and then a further treaty between Great Britain, that was Scotland and England together with Ireland in 1800, and that was partly abrogated in 1922, and we still have problems in Ireland over the question of the maintenance or abolition of union involving part of Ireland. Well, there we go. The same goes for Catalonia and Basque Country and Galicia and other parts of the Spanish kingdom. Italy was brought together in a union only very late in the 19th century. Around the same time, Savoy and other parts became part of France, and so on. The old imperial federal Germany became, after the awful experience of the Nazi rule, the Federal Republic of 1949. All these are states with internal diversity, and the internal diversity includes national diversity, where you have ancient senses of nationality of the Scots, of the English, of the Welsh, of the Catalans, of the Basques, Andalusians, and so forth. Always, I think, in a way that was not particularly of not particularly high visibility, the cultural political facts had a kind of legal constitutional parallel to some extent. For example, in the United Kingdom, Scotland and England, when they united in 1707, did so on the agreement that they should keep separate legal systems and court structures and other aspects of civil society, so that within the one legal polity there were sub-polities with distinctive civic institutions, and so on. One of the interesting developments of the 20th century has been the growth of politics of identity, the growth of a sense that as power centralizes in some respects, for example, beyond the great states into the European Union, so it should decentralize in other ways, and countries like Scotland, Wales, Catalonia, the Basque Country, increasingly claim to assert national rights within this greater entirety. And this has been brought about. The Spanish post-Franco constitution provided for autonomous regions and nationalities to take a place within the new democratic state. The United Kingdom, a series of legislations, first of all attempted in the 1970s, made successful in the 1990s, have created or recreated parliaments in Scotland and Wales and National Assembly an assembly in Northern Ireland. And there's some movement towards reforming the internal governance of England as well. So that there's been, you might say, a diffusion downwards of power, as well as a concentration upwards of certain powers. And this raises that whole issue, which you mentioned, of subsidiarity. What's the right way to ensure that powers, if exercised as close to the citizen affected as is exercised as close to the citizen affected as is possible, consistently with efficiency in pursuing the end and with equity, fairness among different communities in the whole. So that I think is a question again, and it means that not merely has some part of sovereignty been surrendered upwards, but another part of it has been diffused downwards and outwards.
I hate to say it, but we are out of time. I've been speaking today with Neil McCormick, member of the European Parliament and Regius Professor of Public Law at the University of Edinburgh. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day.